Welcome back. Today we're doing a deep dive into a really significant piece of South African legislation, the Community Schemes Ombud Service Act of 2011.
That's Act number 9 of 2011, yeah. It might sound a bit dry, but if you live in any kind of shared property setup, it's actually quite important for day-to-day life.
Exactly. Think complexes, townhouses, estates, that kind of thing. This act basically sets up the referee for when things go wrong. Okay. Let's unpack this. What's the core mission here? What was the service actually designed to do, and who's it for?
Well, the main goal, really, was to create a dedicated way to handle disputes in what the Act calls community schemes. And crucially, to provide some regulatory oversight, too.
Right. And community scheme itself is quite broad, isn't it? It's not just your typical apartment block.
No, not at all. The definition in the Act is pretty wide. It covers sectional title schemes, share block companies, homeowners associations, your HOAs, retirement villages, you know, basically any setup where people share use of and responsibility for land or buildings.
Okay, so quite a wide net.
Definitely. And as I mentioned, there's sort of a dual job for the service laid out in Section 4. Job one is providing that dispute resolution service we talked about.
The referee role.
Exactly. But job two is maybe less obvious, but just as important.
Yeah.
They regulate, monitor, and control the quality of the scheme's governance documents. Think rules, constitutions.
Ah, so trying to make sure the rules are fair and clear from the start to maybe prevent some disputes.
Precisely. Proactive as well as reactive.
Here's where it gets really interesting. How does it work in practice? Say, I've got a real problem, maybe a persistent noise issue or damage to common property that isn't being fixed. How does the service, CSOS, actually handle my complaint?
Okay, so first, you, as someone materially affected, need to formally apply to the Ombud. That's under Section 38. The Ombud looks at it, and importantly, if it seems like it could be settled amicably, they must first refer it to conciliation. That's Section 47. Think of it as guided mediation. A conciliator steps in, tries to help everyone reach an agreement.
Okay, so step one is always trying to talk it out, basically. But what if that fails? If my neighbor just won't compromise on their, I don't know, their pack of howling dogs?
Right. If conciliation doesn't work or isn't appropriate, then it gets escalated. The application goes to an adjudicator. That's Section 48.
And the adjudicator? This sounds more serious. What kind of power do they have? What can they actually order?
A lot, actually. Section 39 outlines their powers. And it's extensive.
Yeah.
They can make orders about financial things like forcing an adjustment to levies if they're unreasonable.
Okay, that's significant.
Definitely. They can also deal with behavioral issues. You mentioned noisy animals. They could potentially order an animal be removed if it's causing a serious nuisance.
Wow, okay.
And things like works and repairs. They can order the association, the body, corporate, or HOA, to carry out specific maintenance or repairs to common areas.
So they cover money, behavior, maintenance. Pretty comprehensive.
It is. And the Act, Section 50B, stresses they should act quickly, with minimal formality, but still following due process, of course. It's meant to be more accessible than the courts.
But is the order just, like, a strong suggestion? Or does it have real legal weight?
Oh, it has weight. Section 56 is clear. Once an adjudicator's order is finalized, it can be registered with either a magistrate's court or a high court. And once that's done, it's enforced, just like a judgment from that court.
So it becomes legally binding and enforceable.
Absolutely. It gives the whole process teeth.
Let's switch gears slightly. How is this whole service structured and crucially funded? It sounds like quite an operation.
It is. It's established as its own legal entity, a juristic person, managed by a board as per Section 6. That board appoints the key figures, like the chief ombud and the chief financial officer, under Section 14.
Okay, standard structure. But the money, who pays?
Good question. Section 22 covers funding. They get money from Parliament, naturally.
Right.
And they can charge fees for certain services. But a really critical part of the funding model is levies. Levies collected directly from the community schemes themselves. This needs ministerial approval, of course, under Section 59, to set the amount.
Wait, so every owner in a community scheme is indirectly paying for CSOS through their regular levies to the HOA or body corporate?
That's essentially how it works, yes. It creates a direct link and, arguably, accountability back to the schemes they serve.
Interesting model. Is there oversight on CSOS itself?
Yes, definitely.
Okay.
The Minister of Human Settlements holds reserve powers under Section 28. If the service runs into financial trouble or there's mismanagement, the minister can step in. So there are checks and balances.
Okay, so what does this all mean when you boil it down?
I think it means there's now a dedicated specialist channel for resolving those often really frustrating disputes that come up in shared living. It pulls these issues out of the potentially slow and expensive court system.
And puts them into a system that not only resolves disputes, but also has a hand in setting the rules through overseeing governance documents.
It's both referee and, to some extent, rule setter, or at least rule quality controller. It aims for faster, more accessible justice in this specific context. But here's something to mull over, maybe. The Act, in Section 37, gives adjudicators the same kind of legal protection, the same immunities, as a high court judge. That's significant power.
Wow, okay.
So given that level of judicial-type power within what's essentially an administrative body, what should CSOS really focus on most heavily? Should it be purely about enforcing its orders rigorously, or should the bigger priority be, perhaps, education helping owners and schemes manage themselves better to prevent disputes ever getting to the ombud in the first place? Where should the balance lie?